I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio. Today we talk with rural Central Oregon author Bing Bingham. We'll hear about his book, Shaped by the Land, Stories of the Rural American West. He'll be reading from his book at 6 p.m. on March 20th at the American Legion Post 134 in Portland. And in the latter part of the show, we'll get a preview of a film by former Hood River resident and Portland civil rights lawyer Minoru Yasui. His daughter Holly Yasui has made a film with Will Doolittle about Yasui's fight to challenge the constitutionality of a curfew on Japanese Americans in Portland during World War II. The film premieres at the Grand Theater on March 28th, Min Yasui Day, in Salem. Stay tuned. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. Joining me via phone is author and frequent commentator on Stage and Studio. At least he has his commentaries on Stage and Studio, his essays. Bing Bingham, are you there?
Good morning, Dee Mae.
Welcome. How is the weather right now in North Central Oregon?
Well, you may remember last winter, and we all got some snow.
Yeah, well, how has this winter been?
It's been like everywhere else. It's been a kind of a rugged one, but it has melted off out here. And as a matter of fact, we're starting to get the first blasts of pollen coming through.
Oh, really? Oh, so, I think you're a little bit ahead of us. We're still in rain mode here.
Oh, well, maybe it's just a local issue, but we've got some coming through.
Well, you know, the weather is pretty important to your line of work. You are a rancher. What is ranch life like during the winter for you?
In the winter, let me answer that with two answers. In the winter, most of the time, it is pretty slow until it's just you're feeding livestock in the evening, and that's about it. Until February, and then we have sheep and goats on our ranch, and then you're feeding and you're making sure that everybody is either lambing or kidding, and everything works out for all parties. This winter, it was a long trudge through the snow. It just amplified our work by about double. And it was just like everybody else. It wasn't the end of the world or anything close to it, but it was just a lot more work than what it usually is.
Well, when you say we, you really mean you and your wife, right?
Me and my wife.
Yeah, it's a small ranch.
We're a mom-and-pop outfit.
Yeah. But, you know, when I say you're really tied to the weather, I mean, I remember, you know, in conversations past that we've had where you've said, well, we have to drive out and make sure, you know, all of our animals haven't frozen to death. I mean, this is a very real concern.
This would have actually happened this year.
Oh, hon, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Well, it's one of the hazards you get when you're dealing with young animals.
Yeah.
I don't know of anybody that was completely prepared for that winter that we had.
Yeah, it was a pretty rough one here, but I think when we talk about rural versus urban, you know, weather is so much more crucial and can be more life and death for, you know, I mean, there was life and death situations here because we have a huge, you know, homeless population in Portland, uh-huh, of course. But you know, you're also dealing with that too, you know, because if your heat goes out, you're out, you know.
Yeah.
there's no place for you to go.
There's nowhere to go and nowhere to run. This winter, pardon me, we had it was wet, damp, cold, and we had about half a dozen goat kids that it was just, I mean, it didn't hardly break above like 10 to 20 degrees during the day, and it'd get down below zero, and it was a cold,
yeah,
damp, miserable time. And we had maybe half a dozen goat kids that would probably have been fine had it been 10, 15 degrees warmer and without all that humidity. But they didn't hardly get up and move. As soon as the weather broke a week or so later, all of our goat kids and lambs, they're thriving and they're doing beautifully this year.
Oh, that's good to hear.
So, yeah, it's one of those things where it's just a hazard of the business.
Well, your life is shaped by the land, and so is your book. It's your book title, Shaped by the Land, Stories of the Rural American West, and it's a collection of essays from your blog, Dusty Dog Cafe. Yeah, I've always wondered, I don't know why you call it Dusty Dog Cafe. Is that because your dog was named Dusty Dog?
No. It's because over here, I took it from an establishment that I ran into some years back over in Astoria. It's called the Wet Dog Saloon. And I thought, I want to talk about the community over here. I liked that name, and I thought, well, what can I call an imaginary cafe over here that signifies something east of the Cascades? And that's
Dusty Dog.
In rural areas.
Yeah.
And that's how it got the name.
Well, when you say people out here, we said North Central, but if you were to say, what's the closest town to where you are?
Well, you know where Bend is?
Yeah.
Okay. And you know where the Dalles is?
Yeah.
Okay. I live about halfway in between those two out in the desert.
Like Madras or
yes,
Antelope
Madras
around that area?
Feet.
Yeah, post-Rajneeshi land, right?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm probably 30, 35 miles from the old...
Rajneeshpuram.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I remember that, and a lot of people probably new to Portland don't know what that is. So Google it. Well, yeah, tell us about what you like to write about. You say you want to write about your community. So what are some of the stories that you write about?
Well, some of the stories that I write about are just people who don't make news. I spent about 25 years working as a freelance writer, photographer, and radio producer. And I chased stories all the way from Northern California into Eastern Washington. At one time, I was putting like 35,000 miles a year on a pickup truck. And after I would get done filing my reports for the day, I would generally go over to a cafe where the locals gather. And they're easy to spot when you know what they look like. And I'd sit down and have a cup of coffee before I'd go home. Well, inevitably, I'd get into a conversation about people with the local folks. And they would tell me about some of the stories, and we'd begin swapping about stories of local people that we knew. These people weren't newsmakers. These people, if anything, they would fight to get away from being starred in the news. But in the local grapevine, they were well-known people, and things had happened to them that for example, there was one story about a woman. She was 80-plus years old, lived out of the Prineville area. And we had a winter like last winter, and she's since passed, but we had a winter, and she got snowed in. Well, she was a tough old bird, and she got... She ran out of her high blood pressure medicine, and it was getting to be a little bit serious. She was out of chicken food, and she had a deal with a friend. When the snow started piling up, he would fly over once or twice a week, and if she was okay, she would wave with one arm. And if she wasn't okay, she would wave with two arms. Well, one day, when she realized she was in a serious situation, she went out and waved to her friend with two arms. And then next thing you know, the following couple of days, they had guys in on snowmobiles to see if she was okay. She gave them a list of her needs. They went back out two more days. They were back in, and they dropped everything that she needed out of a plane, that was swooping over her little valley.
Wow.
Yeah, it's stories like that.
That is incredible.
Of hope and humanity and community.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dima Roberts talking with writer Bing Bingham. He'll be reading from his book, Shaped by the Land, Stories of the Rural American West, and that's on March 20th at the American Legion Post 134 in Portland at 6 p.m. Bing, some of the stories that you have on your Dusty Dog Cafe blog are pretty incredible and moving. The most recent one was the great horned owl named Mariah. Like the wind called Mariah on a painted wagon. So tell us her story and her caretaker story.
Well, I would imagine most of your listeners are familiar with OMSI.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay, and maybe even a good bunch of them are familiar with that OMSI has a remote camp called Camp Hancock. It's out near the John Day River, probably about 40, 45 miles from where I live. And as it happened, just when I was out talking with friends and people that I know, somebody brought up the subject of Moriah. And that was what, and that was how the story got started. Moriah lived for like 20 years in captivity, and that's really unusual for a great horned owl, but she really didn't have many options. She was an owl that, for some reason, probably close to 25 years ago, got caught in a barbed wire fence, and she damaged her wing beyond repair. Well, they were about, at that time, 2 hours away from the closest veterinarian. And they had a guy, a fellow, a camp director named Joseph, who they had a choice. We can either save this owl's life, who has plenty of life left in her, or we can put her down, or we can deplete her on a long old run into a vet who may or may not be able to help her at all. So what he did was he got out a pair of loppers, you know, limb loppers like y'all, like everybody uses to trim in their yard, and he took off the wing that was not salvageable and said, well, let's give her a try at making her a, you know, a display for all the middle school kids that come to the classes out here. And that's, it turned out she was a highly amenable owl, and she was just great. And for like 20 years she was greeted all the fifth grade middle schoolers, or all the middle schoolers, rather, that came out to Camp Hancock as part of one of their demonstrations. She was part, but that was how she got to be where she was. She passed about a year and a half ago. She had an eye infection that was getting increasingly painful. And so they had a vet come out, and they helped her pass peacefully in, you know, so that, you know, she wasn't in pain anymore.
But she lived a long life as a one-winged
owl. Oh, yeah.
Owl.
Oh, yeah. She learned real quick that it was much easier to depend on frozen mice from labs than it was to go out and hunt up your own grub every day.
Well, it's a very compassionate story, and I find that, you know, most of your stories have compassion in them, even with difficult subjects. By the way, was that crows I just heard in the background?
Crows?
Yeah, I thought I heard birds in the background.
Oh, that might have been the wind whistling through my window.
Oh, okay, so
I'm
we're getting some
office,
sound effects.
I got the windows partially open here.
Well, but I'm also moved by, you know, when you talk about a neighbor needing an airdrop during the frozen winter, I don't think a lot of urban folks really realize the distances there are. I mean, you know, that how long it would take to reach a veterinarian or a hospital or emergency room, or even to get basic, you know, services like first responders, you know. Can you tell us about this long distance?
Well, let me describe my community a little bit. I live in a community that is, well, there's 50 people in our whole zip code. I can't, you know, and that's not houses, that's people. I can't see anybody's porch light from my house. My closest neighbor is over a mile away. And in order for me to get into town for very basic shopping, it's a 50-mile round trip. That's in the Madras, where they have like 2 grocery stores, you know, a Bi-Mart, and things like that. That's just your basic everyday shopping. If I'm going to do extended shopping, I have to either decide whether I'm going to go to Bend, which is 75 miles one way for me, or if it's if I come to Portland, which is only 120 miles. So at a minimum, for anything beyond basic shopping, I am doing 150 miles.
Mm.
Now that's if you. That's not a bad thing. No,
but it gives you a perspective.
Yeah,
you know, a perspective on many things, actually.
And I am not the most remote one. Out here, air life is a very important thing because GPS doesn't always work correctly with
and
the roads.
And neither does the internet, right?
Exactly. You know, I have good DSL service. It's fairly slow because I'm at the end of the line, and I like to tell people I live near the edge of the earth. But this is not the most response. The people who provide services like internet are, while they're good, and I got no complaints with them, but they have other responsibilities with more people involved. And, you know, that in generally in larger population areas. And that's just the way it works.
Well, how do people get news when you're so far away from each other?
You get it. In my case, I get it on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
I can listen to, and I usually stream it, but I can listen to NPR every morning. That's how I get my news.
But a lot of people don't even get radio signals, do they?
No,
yeah.
You don't. You have to either get it on, let's say, Facebook or social media if you've got access to it.
If you've got internet, yeah.
If you've got it. You know, for example, at my house, I don't have any cell service.
Yeah, I remember asking you for your cell phone, and you said that won't work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can go 30 feet straight up in the air and get a cell signal, but that's a little uncomfortable up there.
I think it's really important for urban folks to realize, you know, just how remote, you know, our state can be, you know, for the eastern part of the state. In the past, you and I have talked about the urban-rural divide in Oregon. Do you think it's even more pronounced now after this last election?
No, I don't. I think, you know, I think everybody's got their opinions right now. Pardon me. And everybody, and for some reason, everybody seems bent on telling everybody their opinions. And I think the urban-rural divide, you see, most of the political power and strength in our state is lodged over in the Willamette Valley, from Eugene north to Portland. But the rest of the state, which is like three-quarters of the state, if not a little bit more, is populated by us. We're the same people as you, but we just have more space in between us.
Wow. Well, that's a big statement there. I mean, do you feel that you can be vocal, though, about your beliefs there?
I can. Oh, sure.
You do?
I can be vocal, and okay. I will offend a few people. Just as if you were vocal about your beliefs, and I bet you you're going to offend some people.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah.
But it depends on who you're talking to, too, doesn't it?
Exactly.
I don't want to get, you know, too far into this because it's a huge subject, but what is health care like for farmers and ranchers in your area?
Spotty.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the county I live in, Jefferson, is one of the poorest in the state because we're one of the most culturally diverse counties in the state, but we are one of the poorest. And many people, because we're agriculturally based, just can't afford it. Just can't. You know, there are people out there who, you know, got nothing else except Medicaid and Medicare. And, you know, and the Oregon Health Plan. That is it. It's hard to make that choice between your kids eating next week and paying for health care.
So have you talked to your friends and neighbors about the change in the Affordable Care Act and all that? Have you talked to them? Do you approach that subject?
No, not really. They can make up their own mind.
But do they know about the new, you know, what the new plan is?
They do.
And
they
what's
do.
The mood about that?
It varies. You know, there are people out here, it's just like if someone in Portland walked out on the street and asked people, what do you think about this?
Well,
you're going to get a variety of opinions.
Right.
And you're going to get the same over here. There's just more space in between us.
Hmm.
And I've got people over here that are just incensed about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also got people over here that feel free to give me their opinion. They think it's a wonderful thing.
Okay.
I don't know why.
So there's division even in your area, right? It's not just the rural-urban divide at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so let's talk about your reading. You're going to be reading from your book, Shaped by the Land, and we're coming to a close here, Stories of the Rural American West, and that's March 20th, next Monday at 6 p.m. at the American Legion Post 134. You know, it seems like Post 134 has been presenting a lot of writers and artists that are, you know, in some respects, when you think of American Legion, you don't associate with them. You know, some of it doesn't have anything to do with military. And it seems like they're really reaching out to established artists and writers from all over.
In my mind, Dime, I think that is a wonderful thing. In my opinion, you know, which is just, I'm just another guy voicing yet another opinion. but I think the American Legion needs to adapt and change. And too long, you know, they've been known as a bunch of old guys.
But there's a lot of young folks now, right,
exactly.
Running it. So what are you going to be reading? What are your readings like?
What are my readings like? What I do, I use my performing storyteller background. I used to live in Portland, and I came out here and hung out my shingle as a performing storyteller. And that's part of where I got my stories, is I basically almost starved to death doing that, and so I got into writing and photography and just continued my stories in another form. And so I take what a storyteller does, it's similar to an actor. He takes the story, and he's not only reading it or speaking it with his voice, he's using his body, his facial expressions, and his body language to enhance that story. Now, I don't do it like some of the diehards do it, where I don't have any props. I've got a book in my hand, and I'm prompting myself out of it. But my stories are very active. You know, I'm using my voice, as you well know, from the radio business, to my best advantage. So I'm telling the story with not only my voice, my body, and my face, but my whole being is telling that story.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you in Portland, Bing. It's been a long time. Bing Bingham, performing stories from his book, Shaped by the Land, Stories of the Rural American West, 6 p.m. March 20th, American Legion Post 134. That's located at 2104 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. And Bing, you know, it's been great having you. I'll have links to this event and to your blog, DustyDogCafe.com, at stageandstudio.org or kbu.fm/stageandstudio. Bing Bingham, thank you for joining us from your ranch in North Central Oregon near Madras. Looking forward to seeing you here.
And thank you, D-May. It's been a pleasure.
You take care.
You too.
I'm D-May Roberts, Stage and Studio. March 28th is Minoru Yasui Day in all of Oregon. The new documentary film, Never Give Up, Minoru Yasui and the Fight for Justice, Part 1, will have a free screening at the Grand Theater in Salem. Min Yasui was posthumously awarded a Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2015. March 28th is the day he initiated the constitutional legal case to challenge a discriminatory curfew in Portland. Last year, the state legislature voted unanimously to honor March 28th as Minoru Yasui Day. The civil rights leader was the son of immigrant parents from Japan. He grew up in the farming community of Hood River in Oregon in the early 1900s and graduated from the University of Oregon in 1930s. On March 28th, 1942, he challenged the curfew imposed on people of Japanese ancestry and was arrested and jailed for 9 months. Afterward, he, like more than 100,000 Japanese Americans, was imprisoned in an internment camp. Holly Yasui started producing the film to honor her father. Here's a clip from Never Give Up, Minoru Yasui and the Fight for Justice.
A date which will live in infamy. United States of America deliberately attacked by Japan.
It seemed to me that a military order distinguishing between one citizen on one hand and another citizen on the basis of ancestry was absolutely wrong.
I did approach a police officer, and I had my birth certificate with me, and I proved that I was a person of Japanese ancestry, asked the officer to arrest me.
It caught cost him a lot. You know, his freedom, his reputation.
One of the things that Dad was very adamant about is that he insisted that the community, and indeed our family, really sink their roots deep and become American.
Without having any kind of charges filed against us, we were never placed before a jury of our peers, and yet a military commander fighting the Second War at home was saying to you, because of your ancestry, you go into a prison camp.
There is no amount of money that can ever repay us for the kinds of things that we underwent. Who can put a price tag upon that kind of confinement?
And Mr. Yasui was very committed to equality for all people.
Mr. Yasui was always in the office. At times I thought he lived there.
My children and my grandchildren are part of continuing the struggle.
He demonstrated that this is a lengthy process. You definitely have to be able to persevere.
Min is probably recognized best for his tremendous redress efforts, traveling around the country, giving speeches. We saw the president signing that bill, and my greatest regret is, it shouldn't be me. It should be Min. That was very poignant.
He had fought all his life.
Never Give Up, Minoru Yasui and the Fight for Justice, premieres at Grand Theater at 191 High Street in Northeast Salem at 6:30 with a performance by Portland Tyco. And the film's also going to be screened in Hood River on April 2nd at the Columbia Center for the Arts and April 3rd at the Hood River Middle School. And you can find all that info at minoruyasuifilm.org or stageandstudio.org or kibu.fm/stageandstudio. That's it for Stage and Studio today. Thanks to engineer Judy Feistel. And we'll have all of this online later today. Join me on facebook.com/stage, the letter N studio, or tweet me at stage, the letter N studio. Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts.